Factopia. Tektopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi, udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Ugeavisen Ingeniøren, med støtte fra Innovation Center Danmark, Messecenter Herning og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tektopia. Er science fiction en god måde at forestille sig fremtiden på? Og nu taler jeg ikke bare som litteratur, men som en metode til at finde ud af, hvordan fremtiden den bliver, og hvordan man kan udvikle teknologi, der passer til den fremtid. Det er noget af det, den amerikanske kunstner Mirabelle Jones hun kigger på i sin udstilling Future Technology Products, altså produkter, teknologiprodukter for fremtiden. Den kan man for tiden se på Catch i Helsingør. Og ikke alene så kigger hun på science fiction. Hun kigger også på en science fiction, som er skrevet ikke af gamle, hvide, heteroseksuelle mænd, som man siger, men af en gruppe af science fiction forfattere, som er mere bred. Den inkluderer naturligvis kvinder og folk af forskellige racer, men den inkluderer også folk af det, man kunne kalde for flydende køn. Hele ideen er naturligvis, at alle grupper i samfundet skal have en stemme, når det handler om science fiction og forestilling om den fremtid, vores fælles fremtid, hvordan den kommer til at udvikle sig, fordi vi kommer alle sammen til at leve den fremtid, uanset hvad vi nu engang er for nogen, eller hvad vi bekender os til. Jeg har lavet en interview med Mirabelle Jones, og det blev foretaget live på åbningen af udstillingen Future Technology Products på Catch i Helsingør. Så vi stiller om til havnefronten i Helsingør, hvor jeg lægger ud med at bede Mirabelle Jones om at præsentere sig selv.
So I'm an artist and creative technologist, and I'm from Oakland, California originally, and I've been in Denmark about a year. I'm here for good, so Denmark is stuck with me. But I come from a artistic background that's actually focused in bookmaking. My MFA is in book art and creative writing, and I'm a self-taught programmer. I never actually went to school for programming. I just learned everything myself. And then I also have worked as a senior designer developer previously for an organization called Meow Wolf, which builds interactive installations. So my background is pretty eclectic, and I like to take that interdisciplinary process and apply it to a number of different fields.
And now we're sitting here surrounded by what you call a future technology products. What is a future technology product?
So I've become really interested in product design and the interactions that happen between product design and artistic design practices, and at what point something becomes a product, when we can decide that a product is useful or usable and widely applicable. Most of the time, products are designed with a kind of generic audience in mind. And unfortunately, that generic audience often ends up being white, male, able-bodied people. And so a lot of people get left out of those considerations. And I think that probably the most notorious example of this is products that are related to women and childbirth and breastfeeding, and also things like voice recognition software that's trained on male voices. So I was very interested in this, and I was also interested in, I'm an avid reader, I have a literary background, so I was influenced by science fiction and by looking at the different technologies that are evident there and how those influence what we end up developing. So things like the iPad and submarines, those all came from sci-fi. But what would emerge from sci-fi written by a more diverse group of authors? So that's what you see in the room.
So the artifacts on this exhibition, could one consider them to be sort of like messages from the future?
I mean, I don't know actually if these would be successful products, is the funny thing. They're created in a way that's very prototypey and very honest about their prototypical nature. They're all 3D printed. I've been assembling different tutorials along the way that I could use as a way of disseminating the design practice and also creating an educational toolkit that goes along with what I'm doing, so that if people want to make something like the things I'm making, they can have access to that technology. So in a sense, these aren't actually future technology products. They're sort of a stab at what a future technology product might look like.
But they're inspired by specific science fiction writers. Who are these writers?
So the three that I selected, it was really actually hard to narrow it down. I would say the first month of the residency was just avid reading and just like pouring through books. But in the end, I decided on Nnedi Okorafor, who writes a lot of Afrofuturism and African futurism. She distinguishes between those two. And then Ted Chiang, who writes a lot of hard science fiction and is a Chinese-American author. And James Tiptree Jr., who's, despite the name, actually a woman who used that as a pen name in order to enter into the science fiction world. And then it created quite a stir when people found out that James Tiptree Jr. was actually a woman.
So how are they different from like old male white science fiction authors?
That is a really good question, and that's actually part of the focus of this, is what are the values that are inherent in these technologies? What are the worlds that are constructed? I think that it's important to listen first and presume that it's important to have a diverse group of speakers in the room. It's not, in the end, the same thing having everyone say, you could argue that, a white man might have said the same thing. In fact, that's an argument I will hear a lot. but that doesn't matter. You need to really listen to who is creating these works and who's what they're offering. And so adjacent to the reading I've been doing in science fiction, I've been doing a lot of reading around design justice and diversity design practices. And those involve a different approach to design, where you're actually looking at who might your technologies impact that you're not thinking of, who might be negatively impacted or who might be left out of the design process. And then how can you bring those people in and really get a round group of voices that share their opinions and also show your gratitude for those opinions. So it's a really different lens on design. And so I'm combining that with speculative design to see what out there ideas might be.
So to create the possibility of a different future?
Perhaps, yeah. Again, it might be the same future, but I think it's important to include a variety of different voices to see what guides us there.
Is science fiction sort of a good tool for predicting the future? I mean, some science fiction is actually quite dystopian.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, in some cases, I guess it helps us reflect on where we're headed. And where we might not want to be headed. So the James Tiptree Jr. piece in particular is about a world that becomes so saturated with advertisements that they eventually just make it illegal to have advertisements. And so there needs to be alternate systems of creating advertisement. And so what they do is they create this system that's a feedback system where when you're watching television or engaging in some kind of entertainment, this sensor system will inform your providers, and they can actually change the programming based on that sensor input to give you more of what you're reacting to. And we see this happening in more subtle ways with TV, where things just get more, sensationalist, and it becomes all about spectacle, and we lose some of the subtlety of plot. And so I think that piece is a really good indicator of a world that maybe we don't want. We want to think critically about entertainment and what we find entertaining and what that means in terms of our relationship to capitalism and consuming media.
So we have three different objects from the future in the room right now. And the hard thing is to describe them on radio, but we have to give it a try. There's one over there which looks a bit like a flower. What is this?
So this is the E. protea, and it's modeled after a sugar bush, which is a flower that grows in South Africa in the jungle. And it's based on a story by Nnedi Okorafor called The Lost Tree Frog, or Lost Diary of Tree Frog Number 7.
And that was the female science fiction writer?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Afrofuturism.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Afrofuturism.
Yeah. And so in the story is actually written from the perspective of a tree frog, as the name implies. And the tree frog exists in this world where plants have basically figured out a way to merge with e-waste and grow into computers. And it's beneficial to a lot of the animals to be around these plants because they're a form of gathering of consciousness.
So this is a computer plant?
It's a computer plant, yes. Yeah.
And what does it do?
At the moment, it has a camera in it, and it's surveilling the gallery periodically. And then it has a display that's on the inside of the bulb of the plant and the flower. And it will periodically show that footage and then mix it with various images from just things on the internet. So, footage of the jungle or footage of people working with technologies or so on. And then it also has these leaves that have tiny displays that do the same, but without the camera element to it.
So it's sort of a surveillance flower?
It's kind of, yeah, it's an internet of plants plant is kind of how I'm thinking about it. And it's interesting because it's displayed alongside Grow Your Own Cloud. And Grow Your Own Cloud is about how we store data in actual organic plants. So in some ways, they're very much in conversation with each other. They're kind of doing the opposite thing.
But what kind of future do they see this in?
I like to think of this as a kind of future in which plants respond to our technologies and to our consumerism. What evolves out of that, out of our use of technologies and out of our e-waste? How can that transform? And again, this is highly speculative, but it's an interesting thought exercise because we often think about us having an impact on the planet, but does the planet respond? How does the planet respond? How might the planet respond? And it's an interesting path to walk down.
So the idea then is that e-waste can become plants or sort of merge with nature and something new will...
Yeah,
grow up.
And this is actually, again, to look at Grow Your Own Cloud. It's already, things are happening. We are impacting the environment. The environment is responding. Maybe not in this kind of way where it's growing 3D printed TFT display embedded creatures yet. But but who knows what will happen. And in a smaller way, we might think about what will happen with the chemicals that we're imparting to the planet from our design and development practices. What happens there? What ends up evolving or growing from all of that waste and all of that toxicity?
So some sort of a digital Anthropocene kind of vision?
Yeah, something along those lines.
Okay. Should we have a look at the next one over there? It's the deep fake one.
Yep. So these are two 3D printed crystal looking objects, and they both also have displays in them. There's a lot of displays in this exhibit, and part of the fun has been seeing how these speculative works have mixed with my experience in being in a new country and also being in a new country during lockdown and spending a lot of time on screens. and I guess I must have been, realizing this and making the work because nearly everything has a screen in it. But these each have a screen inside of them. And then on the screen, there's me and then there's deepfake me. And we're having a conversation. So the conversation is between me and this quantum version of myself in another timeline who didn't leave the United States, who ended up staying in the United States, didn't end up getting married, didn't end up moving. And I've been thinking a lot about what that would have been like, what that split might have meant. And it's based on Anxiety is the Dizziness of Freedom, which is a story about quantum worlds and a culture in which, or a society in which people have the ability to talk to different quantum versions of themselves using this service. So you go into the service and you say, you know, I'd like to find a version of me that married my high school sweetheart, or I'd like to find a version of me that you know, doesn't have a gambling problem, or what have you. And then they actually find that version of you using these prism devices that look sort of like smartphones. And then you can have a conversation. And in the story, a group of people get addicted to doing this. And so there's a support group for them. And I thought this was really fascinating because I am a proponent of multiple worlds theory. I believe that everything that can happen is happening in some branch of reality. It really helps me with regret, actually, because I don't regret things as much because some other version of me is doing that thing. But I do wonder a lot, what, you know, where am I on that scale of things happening? What are the other versions of me doing? And so in this piece, I actually am talking to the other version of me that did stay in the States, and we're having a conversation about some of that and a little bit of that weird schadenfreude or self-schadenfreude that happens from thinking like, oh, well, things could be worse. There could be a worse version of my life, that kind of thing.
It also sounds a bit schizophrenic.
Yeah, it is. It's like, it is oddly like that. And it has a bit of Uncanny Valley to it as well, which I think is something that deepfake in particular really does to people. It's the original idea for this piece was to have an actual app that would allow people to talk to a deepfaked version of themselves in real time. That would be that quantum version. And unfortunately, the technology is just not there. There's just too much processing time needed. I tried everything, trust me. it's just not there. So I have a version of it that I am doing where for 10 people, I'm doing a performative interpretation of this where they'll send me a short video of them asking them their other self questions, and then I will create a deep fake for them and then send it back to them. And so this isn't something that's outward facing, it's just between me and them, and it maintains that sort of intimacy. And part of that is because there are so many privacy issues around deep fake. And also, I think there's just increasingly a lot of tension around people's images being freely available and used or misused on the internet.
There's a thing about quantum theory that if you interfere with the experiment, you destroy the experiment. Mm. So if you start talking to a deepfake version of yourself, won't you influence the deepfake version of yourself and sort of make it, evolve in a different way?
Yeah, well, in the story, I'm just going to basically tell you the story.
Okay.
Sorry.
Cool.
I should have just called the show spoilers. in the story, there's actually some shady business going on between two of these crystal dealers where they're tricking this older woman into giving up her money by saying that her other quantum self needs it. and so that's a very interesting misuse of the technology. But it does bear in mind like the things that one could do with deepfake, which is a similar kind of experience, right? Where you can fake that someone else has done something or said something. And so the possibilities for using that technology for something like blackmail or to ruin someone's reputation is fairly high. So there's a lot of crossover there.
Will this be sort of is this imagined as a commercial product or in the future?
I think in this story, it is a commercial product because people go to this service and pay to use these devices, and the devices have a limited lifespan because they're a physical technology. And the crystal runs out in the prisms, but, yeah, I think in this one, it's interesting because what it ended up being is sort of, to use your term in terms of like talking to oneself or having a conversation that's a little odd, it ended up sounding a lot like therapy or some of those self-help app therapeutic processes where you converse with a chatbot and, you know, in a like Rogerian therapist kind of way, they ask you like, oh, well, what do you think about that? How do you feel about that? And so I think if this did end up being a product, it would be something akin to the performance that I'm doing, where it's really working through the thought exercise of what would that other person be like? What can that process of thinking about that do to help you in order to feel more secure or know what changes you have to make in your life?
What about the question of which one of these versions of yourself is the real one?
It is a good question. I mean, in the story, they all are real, but they're not, you know, instantialized, real, corporeal, real. So I think as a thought exercise, all versions of you are real, but you are the you that you are.
Should we have a look at the last one,
mm-hmm.
which is called the, oh, it has a brilliant name, which is hard to say, Influencicizer.
The Influencicizer. Just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
Yeah, Influencicizer. Try to say, could you all say it? We have an audience. Once more, loud.
Influencicizer.
It's possible. I actually did mention for the radio listeners, we have an audience of roughly 25 people or 20 people. And it's actually very different because usually I know I have only male listeners, but most of the people in the room are women. So that's great. The Influencicizer.
Yeah, so in the story, The Girl Who Is Plugged In, there actually isn't a name for this product, so I had to create one. It's a technology that's kind of ubiquitous. It's just used as the media is used, as television is used. So there's a sensor system that attaches to the viewer, and they're not entirely clear about what this system is like. This was another interesting part of this process, is seeing how much of the objects and the technologies and how they work and how they look and what they do is really described in the literature, and how much of it I have to speculate on and really like come up with my own opinions on. And so for this piece, I decided to change it a bit because I wanted to make a COVID-friendly version. And even though I often work with sensors in my own work and I really enjoy that process, they require contact most of the time. So I decided to do an eye-tracking piece. And this actually also evolved out of a previous idea I had, which is having artworks that respond to attention and respond to gaze and respond to expression and what those might look like. And so I decided to sort of merge that project with this idea of the media server system that has content that's changed by the viewer and what the viewer is paying attention to. So in this piece, it becomes more or less convoluted based on gaze and based on attention. And so there's a, it's actually a Python library called dlib, and it's analyzing 68 dots of your face in order to determine your face. So it also could do facial expression recognition, but I decided not to do it, too sick for this one. And then it's just looking at your pupils and where those are based in relation to the screen in order to determine if you're paying attention or not. And it also can detect when there's no one in front of it, too, so that it turns off, which is nice for the gallery. But I could see this kind of, this is a technology that's already being used, right? Like we have, you know, we use heat maps and that sort of thing when we're determining, when we're in an R&D process often, in order to determine where people are looking, how we should base our content, especially how it's displayed on a screen. And I think it's just a small jump to think, how would this be used in a real-time environment in order to change content in real time, in order to keep people's attention in the way that happens in the story, in order to keep them coming back for more? And what would that do to content? How would that evolve? And how would it influence what's created?
So the content would change over time while you're sitting on your sofa watching it to keep you there.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So if you start to look away, it might, like, I don't know, add flashing lights. In this one, there's like some explosions and stuff.
To keep your attention. I
won't spoil it.
Okay.
But there's stuff to keep your attention.
In the novel, what does this technology do?
In the novel, it's a sensor system. And it's not, like I said, it's not entirely explained. But the idea is that it analyzes how some biometrics related to the individual and their response to the media. And so that it changes the actual television programming. So the television programming might become, like if the person is responding favorably, whatever the algorithm has determined favorably is. I should also note that this was written in 1971. So this is an older piece. But it in many ways represents what we have today. So it anticipated a lot of our ideas around influencer culture and media consumption. But the idea is that the programming would change automatically based on that algorithm, and people would be served more of what they're enjoying, or if they weren't enjoying it or weren't responding to it in the way that the algorithm had determined is favorable to keep their engagement. And that, I think that term is really key with this piece, that it would switch it to something else.
If you look at science fiction, could you say that it's more than a picture of the future? It's sort of like a representation of the present, maybe a dystopian or utopian representation of the present?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think that's why it's important to read diverse voices in science fiction as well. Because I know for me, I read a lot of white male authors in science fiction when I was a kid. And I love them. I still, to this day, love them. Philip K. Dick is one of my favorite authors. He's great. Ray Bradbury as well, Kurt Vonnegut. But I also noticed that the women characters in those didn't really have much of a presence. They didn't really have like a round character. They're fairly flat. And I think it was when I read Ursula Le Guin and when I read Octavia Butler that I really was like, wow, I have like this other level of relatability to this content, where it helps me figure out my place in the world and where I might go and what I think about reality. And that's incredibly important. So I think that it's very important to look at science fiction, not just from the perspective of, oh, we don't want this to happen, but also to look at it from the perspective of who is in this world, be it dystopian or utopian. What are they doing? What are they interacting with? What does that reflect about the values of this culture? And also, how does that relate to me as a reader and as a person who is from a number of different cultures? How does that relate, and what can I learn from that?
In the crystal ball of Mira Jones, what do you see if I look into it, the future in like 5-50 years, or maybe for an eternity?
Mm. I mean, I think still screens. I think screens aren't going to go out of fashion. I think that AR in particular and MR are going to become more and more a part of our world. I think the screens will become less something that we hold at a distance and more something that is attached to us as a wearable, as an object that we carry around with us. So I think that things like AR glasses will have a tremendous impact on how we interact and the kinds of technologies that get developed in terms of that being a platform. And then I'm not entirely sure about things like television. I'm not a big TV watcher, but I have a feeling that more and more independent content is going to become normal because it's already going that way. And so I think that there'll be more independent producers, there'll be more sort of smaller cultures supporting other people that are creating content within those cultures. So that it becomes less of, this is kind of a hope of mine, I guess, is that it becomes less of what does HBO want to show us and more of what is my friend Sarah producing this week. And again, I think that that's already starting to happen.
How will it impact the future of our species? I mean, when it comes to gender, race, and some of the issues which is described in these pieces?
It's a good question. I think if we, I think it is not possible for us to continue to develop products and technologies without incorporating a diverse group of voices. I think that's just not possible. We are already driving ourselves into the ground doing that, and we need to listen. I think that there are companies that are really trying to make an effort to do that, and I would encourage them to continue doing that.
Which ones?
I mean, I'm not going to name drop any in particular. I haven't seen any companies that are very large that have done the kind of work that I would consider sufficient for me to like say, oh, great, your work is done. I think that there still needs to be a lot of work. There at least have been acknowledgments from some companies about the fact that they need to work on their hiring practices, that they need to work on their outreach practices. I think especially with Black Lives Matter happening, there's been a big push for that. But I think what's been lost is that there's this idea that, okay, we'll hire a bunch of developers and designers, but then what? Like, it's not enough to just hire people. There has to be some kind of process for incorporating those voices. And also, it's not limited to just hiring designers and developers, because then you can claim it's a bottleneck, right? That the system isn't producing enough designers and developers who are diverse, which is the line that companies give pretty continuously. There are other ways to involve people. So diversity justice design says that we can incorporate voices as part of our feedback cycle. So when we're doing research and development, we can actually pay people in the communities that we might impact to share their opinions, to test the technologies, to redesign with their needs in mind. And I would love to see that happening more.
Thank you. I can hear there's some construction going on, so we might stop it here. But thank you for participating in Techtopia.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Og det sagde altså den amerikanske queer-kunstner Mirabel Jones. Du kan finde mere om udstillingen på websitet futuretechnologyproducts.com, og på mirabeljones.com kan du læse mere om kunstneren Mirabel Jones, der blandt andet er fortaler for det, hun kalder for STEAM i stedet for STEM. Hun har simpelthen puttet et A ind, så man også får art, altså kunst, med ind i de naturvidenskabelige fag, fordi hun mener, at kunsten er en vigtig måde at fortolke teknologien på. I denne her uge har vi også fået et podkort fra podcasten Transformator, som Ingeniøren udgiver.
En del af de lidt ældre lyttere kan nok nikke genkendende til den her lyd. Den gode gamle pladespiller til vinylplader er ikke nogen ny opfindelse, men nu er den altså blevet fornyet, efter at B&O har samlet gamle modeller ind af den gamle Beogram 4000 og givet den et nyt og moderne liv. I ugens Transformator skal vi snakke om gamle opfindelser, der har fået nyt liv. Så vi skal også høre om UVC-lys, der længe har været brugt i svinestallene, men som nu skal bygges ind i hotellerne for at stoppe coronaen. Og så skal vi høre om noget, der lyder som gamle skibersgrøne. Noget om at blande chili i bundmaling til skibe. Lyt med i Transformator.
Du har lyttet til Techtopia. Du kan finde os på techtopia.dk, hvor jeg også linker til emner fra udsendelsen. Du kan følge os på Twitter, @techtopia.dk. Du kan skrive til mig på henrik@techtopia.dk. Og du kan deltage i diskussionen om teknologi på i vores Facebook-gruppe. Den hedder Techtopia Backstage. Og inden jeg ser på genhør, så vil jeg opfordre til, at du går ind og abonnerer på vores podcast i den podcast-afspiller, du nu engang bruger. Og at du anbefaler podcasten til dine venner og din familie og dine kollegaer, hvis du altså synes om den, hvilket jeg går ud fra, når du har hængt med her i de sidste 33 minutter. På genhør i næste uge. Tektopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi, udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Ugeavisen Ingeniøren, med støtte fra Innovation Center Danmark, Messecenter Herning og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tektopia. Tektopia.